It's Friday, October 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, as Iraqi forces advance on Mosul, Raqqa becomes the next target against Islamic State.
The disparity between the two candidates is so pronounced, it kind of made me just want to jump in the car and get out here and vote today.
U.S. voters are already casting their ballots. Also ahead, Netflix hits a great wall in China's market. And World War II is back on the big screen. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter says he hopes in a matter of weeks to have the forces ready to begin the assault on Raqqa, the last major Syrian city controlled by Islamic State. But the U.S. Commander of Operation Inherent Resolve, Lieutenant General Stephen Townsend, cautioned that Raqqa presents unique challenges not present in the ongoing Iraqi offensive to retake Mosul.
It's going to be with a partnered force rather than the partner being a nation states armed forces like the Iraqi armed forces. It's going to be our partners, our local partners in northern Syria. It's also going to be done with a lot lighter coalition footprint. We'll have fewer coalition troops there. It's a very complicated battle space. There are a lot of regional security concerns that are in competition there. The Syrian regime's involved, the Russians are involved, Turkey's involved. It's hard. And there's a civil war going on right next door. So it's going to be a tough, very tough political environment and a security environment, I think, for our effort there.
Townsend, speaking to reporters at the Pentagon from Baghdad, suggested a sense of urgency to the operation. Referring to Islamic State, he said, "We know that they're up to something, and it's an external plot, but he doesn't know when or where." Syria analyst David Lesh, a history professor at Trinity University in Texas, tells VOA's Victor Beatty nearly simultaneous attacks on Raqqa and Mosul make strategic sense.
Just to make sure that those members of the Islamic State that are fleeing Mosul are not able to acquire a safe haven in Raqqa. However, yes, I mean, the political implications are very, very complicated because in Syria, northern Syria, you have to deal with the Kurdish situation, the Turks, the Russians. There's so many players involved that you have to basically politically settle the situation before you actually enter into the military equation. For instance, the force that the U.S.-led coalition would most rely on the ground are the Syrian Democratic Forces, which are mostly made up of Kurdish groups and some Arab groups. But these Kurdish groups are at odds with Turkey, and in fact, in a little mini war with Turkish forces. And I think the U.S., you know, has been trying to work with Turkey and to try to settle these matters and differences before any assault on Raqqa is implemented. But a lot of political differences with groups on the ground, with regional players, you know, making sure that the forces are separated from where Russia operates so as to deconflict the area. All of these things in Raqqa have to be settled before engaging in an offensive.
As you indicated, the landscape is so much different from Iraq. In Iraq, you have a central government to deal with, whereas in Syria, you really don't.
The U.S.-led coalition and our allies on the ground would, in fact, be working, in effect, on the same side as the Syrian government and its Iranian and Russian backers. Yet, we don't necessarily want to and cannot work with those groups to take on the Islamic State. And particularly, in my mind, the most central feature of this is trying to work out the U.S. relationship with the Kurds in the country of Turkey.
What other groups might also be involved?
Indigenous Syrian Arab forces, Free Syrian Army forces, other groups that have been supported by the U.S., both Kurdish and Arab. You know, by far, the Syrian Democratic Forces, who have been the most effective group fighting the Islamic State on the ground in Syria, are largely made up of YPG elements.
David Lesh says that they've been under attack by Turkish forces. General Townsend said he is in negotiations with Turkey regarding the Kurdish fighters and Ankara's potential role in retaking Raqqa. Lesh says that there are several factors to overcome leading up to the operation, the political negotiations to put together a workable coalition, the actual assault, and the post-fighting period, including the future of Kurdish fighters and what roles that Turkey and the Syrian government will play in a post-Islamic State Raqqa. It's time for us now to check out what's buzzing online, and to do that, our own G. Abby Lee is right here in the studio with today's trending stories. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim. One of the top trending hashtags today is not something you hear all the time. It's hashtag Mormon Mafia. A few days ago, Fox News host Lou Dobbs took to Twitter and called an independent presidential candidate, Evan McMullen, as a tool for the quote-unquote Mormon Mafia on Twitter. Naturally, the internet took that label and just ran with it. Mm-hmm. Dobbs tweeted McMullen is nothing but a globalist, Romney and Mormon mafia tool.
Well, I have to say, that's pretty unusual to hear Mormon and mafia in the same sentence.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And here's what other people tweeted about it. One person tweeted, if you keep mocking the hashtag Mormon Mafia, you might wake up in your bed tomorrow next to a basket of muffins. What kind of image do Mormons have, in your opinion, or in American public?
Well, I mean, they you don't associate them with criminals, necessarily.
Not really. And, you know, they're known to be a pretty gentle group of people. A Mormon woman tweeted that she finds the tweets hilarious, and she even thanked Lou Dobbs.
Well, what did McMullen himself say about the accusation?
Nothing too serious. He's on Twitter at Evan_McMullen, and he sent out this tweet. The strength of at Team McMullen is that we are the hashtag Mormon Mafia and the Jewish, Catholic, Evangelical, Hindu, Muslim, or no mafia mafias. And he added an American flag, hash flag.
All right. What else is trending today?
You know, we talked about Icelandic women protesting against wage inequality just a few days ago. And today, we are going to talk about one specific Icelandic woman. Miss Iceland quit pageant after being told to lose weight. Arna Jonsdottir dropped out of the Miss Grand International contest after the owner of the pageant told her she's too fat. Have you seen her photo by any chance?
Yes, I have. And she didn't seem that heavy.
Yeah, I mean, that was like the general sentiment on Twitter, too. People were like, no, she shouldn't be told to lose weight. She's actually just normal weight. That's all for me today. Jim?
All right. Thanks so much for that wrap-up, G. You can follow us on Twitter anytime you like at @VOA_IE, and be sure to follow also our individual accounts at VOA Stevenson and at G. Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia, U.S. diplomat insists efforts against North Korea's nuclear program is not a lost cause. Pakistani capital bans political gatherings. United States charges 61 in India-based phone scam. Philippine leaders meeting with Japan emperor canceled. Migrants deepen China's ties to Australia. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at the voanews.com website. And if you have a smartphone, you can track everything easily using our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Early voting is underway in more than 35 states, with millions of votes cast already in the U.S. presidential election. The November 8th election is just days away, and the Democratic and Republican parties are urging their supporters to vote early. VOA's Chris Simpkins reports from the crucial battleground state of North Carolina, where early turnout is strong.
Early voting is off to a fast start in the battleground state of North Carolina.
You can vote for all of us, thank you.
Voters on both sides of the political divide are highly motivated by the presidential race between Democrat Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump.
The disparity between the two candidates is so pronounced it kind of made me just want to jump in the car and get out here and vote today.
The illegals that's coming in here and taking people's jobs. Yeah, I'm retired, but it still makes me mad.
Early polling surveys suggest Clinton is doing well in North Carolina, while Trump is showing strength in Ohio.
I'll tell you what, we're doing well in the polls.
But the easier you make it to register and vote,
the more people vote. It's going to increase turnout overall, but probably not exactly the same for both parties. Might benefit one party more than the other, and the general belief is that it benefits Democrats more than Republicans.
Voting rights have been the source of major political and legal battles in North Carolina since 2013. That's when the Republican-controlled legislature passed a law limiting early voting hours and required that voters show photo identification. Lawmakers said the aim was to prevent voter fraud.
We strongly support our state's voter ID laws and believe that it's essential that we have common sense protections to ensure that people are who they say they are when they go to vote.
Earlier this year, an appeals court struck down the voting law, citing evidence that lawmakers used data on black voting patterns before crafting the legislation.
They seemed to act on that data because the decisions they made were the ones that would affect blacks adversely, but not whites.
The controversy surrounding voting rights motivated some people to cast their ballot early.
Don't let nobody suppress your right to vote, because I remember the time when my ancestors could not vote. But now we have a right to vote, opportunity to vote, and I think we should.
I think it's necessary for folks to have options, and to deny that is denying us the process of which we get to speak about our elections.
As the popularity of early voting grows in this state, officials say there's likely to be more early voting in the future. Chris Simpkins, VOA News, Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
And as we mentioned, Election Day is coming up November 8th, and be sure to stop by here at VOA. We're going to have wall-to-wall coverage of all of the results as they come in that night, and we'll be among the very first to let you know who the 45th President of the United States will be. So be sure to stick with VOA throughout the rest of the less than 2 weeks before the election comes up, and then that very night itself. U.S. video streaming service Netflix has hit a bit of a roadblock in its quest to launch throughout the Asian region this year. Last week, the entertainment giant said it's no longer trying to offer streaming services in China in the near term. That's because Chinese regulations on foreign media have become, in its words, more challenging. My colleague Michael Lippin has been looking into the reasons behind Netflix's China setback for this week's VOA China's 360 podcast. He joins me right here in the studio.
Hi, Jim.
Hi, Michael. What did you find?
Well, I found out that China is proving to be a tough environment, not just for Netflix, but for other U.S. entertainment companies as well. One of the analysts whom I interviewed for the podcast is Therese Poletti. She is a senior columnist for the CBS Market Watch news site. I asked Poletti what she thinks about Netflix basically giving up on the China market for the time being.
So far, you know, Netflix is just saying we're not going to be in China right now. And I think most of Wall Street expected this. They didn't really think that they were going to be entering the market soon because it's a very difficult market with censorship. And it's really kind of showing that in order to be in China, you have to work with Chinese companies that are already there so that you can gauge your content for, you know, what is permissible given the censorship laws. Apple and Disney have had problems there, you know, this past summer. The Wall Street Journal wrote about that. They had different things taken down. So, you know, even if companies like that are having issues, it's a very tough market. I mean, when you go to China, you can't even, you know, get Google. You know, there's only a few different American services that you can get there. So, it's just a very different market, and you really have to have partnerships to be there.
Well, Netflix did say that it plans to seek Chinese partners to stream its own content to Chinese viewers, but only expects the revenue from those partnerships to be modest. I also talked to Jeremy Goldcorn. He's the co-host of another China-themed podcast called Seneca. He's written a lot about China's media landscape and spent 20 years in the country before moving to the U.S. last year. Goldcorn thinks that Netflix and other Western media companies don't have much hope of China easing its foreign video streaming regulations anytime soon. But he does see some potential for Western media to succeed in another industry.
I would say the one area where you are seeing a lot of enthusiasm from Western media companies for China is the motion picture business, the traditional motion picture business. And that is a slightly different, how to put it, scene. It's a different scene from what, I mean, Netflix, their business is distributing content. They also make it, but I mean, you know, the way they make their money is as a distribution platform. Whereas, you know, Hollywood movie studios going into business with China, it's slightly different. I mean, what they're doing is they're getting money from China to fund productions. They're hoping that those will be distributed in China, but that's not the only thing that they're relying on as a business. And it doesn't require the same volume, from what I, you know, understand of Netflix's business. Is, you know, if you're a studio, there's a certain number of films you have to make every year, and they have to all be profitable. But you're not having to stream, you know, potentially, you know, hundreds of thousands, or at least, you know, at the very least, thousands of titles on a daily basis, each of which can get you into trouble. If you're a major studio, you know, how many films will you expect to be able to produce and sell, you know, and air a screen in China every year? You know, it's not such a huge number. So even content-wise, the restrictions are somehow more manageable. Although, you know, no doubt some of these Hollywood studios currently getting into bed with Chinese investors expecting great returns in China, you know, many of them are going to have their dreams dashed too. But that is a different business. But that is the one media business at the moment where you still see a great deal of foreign enthusiasm for China.
Well, if you want to hear more from Goldkorn and Paletti about Netflix and its China ambitions, check out my latest podcast on Twitter at VOAChina360, as well as on my new Facebook page, which is under my own name, Michael Lippin. Jim?
All right. Thanks so much, Michael. And be sure to check out the VOA China 360 podcast, one of several that we offer each and every week to China and the Asian region. You can also visit our website at voanews.com for more, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The U.S. presidential election takes place on November 8, 2016. VOA provides extensive coverage of this important political event. Who are the candidates, and what are the issues that will determine who the next president will be? Tune in around the clock for coverage of the U.S. presidential election, right here on VOA.
Jazz America!
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. A new film from director Mel Gibson tells the story of a World War II Army medic who won the Medal of Honor during one of the war's bloodiest battles. International Edition's David Byrd tells us about Hacksaw Ridge, which stars Andrew Garfield, Vince Vaughn, and Teresa Palmer.
This is a personal gift from the United States government designed to bring death to the enemy.
I'm sorry, Sergeant. I can't touch a gun.
You don't kill.
No, sir.
You know, quite a bit of killing does occur in war.
Private Doss does not believe in violence. Do not look to him to save you on the battlefield.
Desmond Doss was a Seventh-day Adventist who believed that his faith forbade him from harming another human being. Doss had wanted to be a doctor, but when World War II started, he joined the Army. Doss's unit was involved in the Battle of Okinawa in 1945, and it was there that he distinguished himself by saving the lives of 75 of his comrades while risking his own life under enemy fire. Doss continued to do his duty even though he suffered serious injuries during the battle, even refusing treatment so another man could be carried from the field. Desmond Doss was the first conscientious objector to be awarded the Medal of Honor for bravery. Andrew Garfield, who plays Doss in Hacksaw Ridge, says that the real-life hero models a kind of strength that is rarely seen.
Well, Desmond models, I think, is a new form of strength, a new form of what it is to man up, to be a man. Well, these ideas that I don't think we quite know what they mean anymore. I know for me as a young man becoming, you know, a boy becoming a man a few years ago, I was looking for heroes to model my masculinity on. So I think Desmond's one of those people that we can look to.
Director Mel Gibson said at the film's premiere that Doss's story was one that needed to be told.
You know, toxic masculinity is this whole idea of punching somebody in the nose and winning through might. Might is right kind of thing. It's not necessarily. This man goes at it like with love and triumphs. And, I mean, he wins the respect of all those around him who thought he was weak and a coward. And he does things that they could never even gotten close to, just the bravery.
Teresa Palmer plays Doss's love interest, Dorothy Schuette, and says the story has the power to touch people.
It's a film with such a profound message. It has the potential to affect positive change in the world. And I just think that it's completely aligned with where Mel's at right now. And he's going to show the world like this is really putting so much of himself out there. He's got a big heart and a beautiful spirit, and I think this film speaks to that.
This is Mel Gibson's first film since Apocalypto in 2006. The director said at the premiere he believes Hacksaw Ridge delivers a great story, even though it did not have the budget of other films.
But the time dictates now that, you know, a film that's not about a guy in spandex, you don't get the budget, you don't get the time. So you have to do what you used to do in half the time with half the money. And I feel like we really got a lot of bang for our buck on this one.
Hacksaw Ridge also stars Vince Vaughn, Sam Worthington, Hugo Weaving, and Mel Gibson's son, Milo. The film is rated R for graphic war violence. It opens in U.S. theaters November 4th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. For the rest of your day, you can check out our website at voanews.com, stop by our Facebook page at VOA Now, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Carl Starling. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The humanitarian and human rights situation in Aleppo is dire. Secretary of State John Kerry described the situation in Syria as one of the largest humanitarian disasters since World War II. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has described Aleppo as a slaughterhouse. The brutal facts, said U.S. Deputy Representative to the United Nations in Geneva, Theodore Allegra, must shock us still further. Over 275,000 people remain trapped in eastern Aleppo. Russia and the Syrian regime's recent assault have killed 400 people, including 100 children, in markets, in bakeries, in schools, at water stations, in mosques, and even in hospitals. Thousands are wounded and cannot access medical care. People are starving and drink contaminated water. The handful of brave doctors and first responders who remain in Aleppo work tirelessly to save lives, even as they face continued assaults. The few remaining hospitals are overwhelmed. People with serious wounds are left on the street in body bags to make room for others who can be treated more quickly. Airstrikes by Russia and the Assad regime are the cause of this devastation, and they are the cause of this suffering, said Deputy Representative Allegra. And let me emphasize, no pause can be a substitute for a genuine end to the violence and full access for humanitarian aid. So Russia and the regime owe the world much more than excuses. Why do they keep hitting hospitals and medical facilities? And why do they keep targeting children and women? These shocking acts in Aleppo, he said, beg for an appropriate investigation, and those who commit them must be held accountable. The United States reiterates its call for an immediate end to all violations and all abuses. Furthermore, the U.S. calls for accountability for those who perpetrate them, especially the egregious, the widespread, and the persistent human rights and humanitarian violations committed by the Assad regime against the Syrian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.